Hello, I'm Richard Feidler. Thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are plenty more conversations about things you're interested in and things you don't know you're interested in yet. Well, until you try them anyway. Go to abc.net.au/conversations or to iTunes, where you can get lots more for free.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. All this week I'll be bringing you some of the best guests of the Sydney Writers' Festival. Imagine for a moment now, though, how it would be if hundreds of thousands of this country's most talented people, the best educated, the most entrepreneurial, the most creative men and women, if they all left and gave their talents to another country for good. This is what happened to Ireland in the 1950s. Some 400,000 of their best and brightest and most energetic young people left to go to America, mostly. This event is the backdrop for the new novel by the great Irish writer Colm Sabeen, who's in Australia for the Sydney Writers Festival. The novel is called Brooklyn, and I have to tell you, it's just wonderful. It's the story of a woman called Eilish. Eilish is young and shy and thoughtful, and with the help of her sister and a priest, she leaves the little Irish town where she thought she'd be spending the rest of her life. She goes on a ship to New York, to Brooklyn. Eilish endures terrible homesickness. Her old life in Ireland seems to dissolve into unreality. But then she finds a kind of happiness, for a while anyway. Colm Sabeen, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you.
I'm still in the afterglow of this novel, which I finished at 4 a.m. this morning. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You were at the White House on St. Patrick's Day this year. Tell me what happened.
Well, you know, it's difficult at the moment to know who Irish to ask out anywhere because the church is in such disgrace. You couldn't really have cardinals and bishops in the White House. And in a way, the state is in such disgrace because of the economy. You couldn't really have too many politicians. You certainly couldn't have economists. And you absolutely couldn't have bankers. So then they think, well, who can you invite? So then they hit on, oh, maybe the writers haven't done that much harm, you know. And so they invited a few. They invited Gabriel Byrne. They invited the Brian F. O'Byrne, who's a great actor. They invited Gary Hines, the great theatre director. And they invited yours truly. So it was great. Gary Hines and myself went down the train from New York, and we queued outside, and it was it was a beautiful day in Washington, D.C., and we went in, and we had a really good position to view the president, but like anyone with a really good position to view the president of the United States, you said, unless you have an armed guard with you, which we didn't have, you get pushed out of the way really quickly by people who think they're more important than you. So one minute we were at the very front, and a few minutes later, I said to Gary, how come we're now like almost at the back? And so it's called pushy people. So anyway, we had our event because the president came back out later and we shook his hand and we did all those sort of things. So that was fine. But what was fascinating was that the three powerful men who came out, Joe Biden, who introduced everybody, the President of the United States, and the Irish Taoiseach, the Irish Prime Minister, Brian Cowan. All three of them have connections to the United States. Joe Biden, in his introduction, said that Brian Cowan, who's the Prime Minister, that his mother, he said, his mother, God rest her, had lived in Long Island for 10 years and then come back to Ireland. And he suddenly looked at the Prime Minister, who was shaking his head, and Biden looked worried and said, oh, is she still alive? And Brian Cowan nodded. And he said, oh, well, God bless her in that case. And everybody thought that was great. Everyone was a very cheerful day.
It's Joe Biden's daily gap.
Yeah, and no one took offense. Yeah. It was fine. But Joe Biden pointed out that his mother was Irish, was of Irish origin. And so the Irish Prime Minister's mother lived in Long Island for 10 years, then came back. And then it was the turn of the president. And the president said that since he's been elected, genealogists have done their work. And on his mother's side, he comes from Moneygall in the Irish Midlands. And he was very funny about this because he said if only he'd known when he was running in Chicago first that he was actually as Irish as he was Kenyan, then he would have got all the Irish voted from the very beginning. And but here were these three men, you know, very powerful figures running things. And there's a shadow, and the shadow is women who left a country years earlier with one suitcase, maybe, and arrived in this strange country, America, from, you know, Ireland. And what they went through, those early years of getting used to it. And in a way, it's the history of Australia. It's the history of North America, that someone or other came first, and that person had a suitcase or left something behind that they liked and had to slowly get used to the new country. And each one did it in a different sort of way. And also, probably what happened, as each person got used to it, they left silence about the things they missed. Would come out maybe at certain times like Christmas, or maybe with the help of drink in certain cases, you know, what they really missed or things they were really thinking about. But what they did was they simply got on with things, and within a short time, maybe 3 or 4 years, the new country was home. And so they lost a home and gained one. But in the meantime, all sorts of things happened that I thought were very dramatic.
I was in Ireland for about 2 months in the early 90s, just before the economic boom started to happen in Ireland. I spent some time in Galway on a little bed and breakfast in a place in Galway, which you might be familiar with, called the Long Walk. And it was explained to me by, it's beautiful there, that this is, it was called the Long Walk because locals would walk along here, this promenade on the edge of the bay, and wave goodbye to their relatives forever. And there was such a sadness in the way this was told to me.
Yeah, the going to America or going to Australia was a very big deal because often people wouldn't return or would return once. And what you'd wait for were these letters which would come in aerogram, you know, paper. And people wouldn't even in the 50s, they wouldn't use the telephone in the 50s. A lot of people in Ireland didn't have telephones in their houses. Going to England was different where you could get work in a factory, say, but you would always be a sort of second-class citizen. So there were two ways of looking at it. If you emigrated to America, you're emigrating into the bright future, into a land of opportunity, into a place where, when I was 8, I was taken out of school in June 1963 to see the President of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, coming back to Wexford, where his ancestors were from and where I'm from. And he's coming back in triumph as President of the United States, a Wexford man, as President of the United States. And that had a big impression on everybody. He was so glamorous and obviously the most powerful man in the world. And so I suppose the difference would be that if you emigrated to England and America would be that your descendants in America could become president. But in England, your descendants could not become queen. You know, that there were laws to stop that, really. You know.
That is still in place today. You mentioned there that the things that aren't spoken of. So many of the important things that are in your novel are unspoken by characters. Things are deeply felt, but not spoken of. Is that culturally an Irish thing to do, Colin?
Yeah. I think that if you're dealing with a talkative society, what you've got to look at if you're a novelist or even if you're anybody is what are they not talking about? And often I think in Ireland, people are not talking about the things that really matter to them. And things that they regret, and it's the not said you're always watching out for. And I think if you're dealing with areas of pain, areas of difficulty, what people will do is just simply keep that to themselves and keep the party going by talking about other things. So as a novelist, you're almost interested in watching the shadows. And if you're looking at a photograph, look at who's that blurred figure that you want to bring into focus, not who's in the middle of the picture. So your job is to sort of nose around the silent, shadowy areas of things and see if you could bring those things out into the open.
Since the boom in Ireland, which you know has come to a bit of a crash in recent couple of years or so, but during the boom, for the first time centuries or so, Ireland has attracted migrants for economic reasons. How much stress has that put on Ireland?
It's put a great deal of stress on Ireland. That Ireland wasn't ready for it, almost culturally. We didn't have a proper debate about it. So when the Nigerians began to come, I noticed there was real racism in the country, which I thought was shocking. And the Chinese will describe it, you know, that they're actually just treated as second-class citizens. And then, of course, when the other countries joined the EU, such as Poland, vast numbers of Polish people arrived. And, of course, they were wonderful. I mean, it was almost fashionable, certainly, to have, if in the gay world, to have a Polish boyfriend. You know, the Poles were amazing. They would go to mass, which we've really stopped doing. And they obeyed rules. And if a Polish guy came to work in your house, got to be incredibly good at what he did, and polite and serious and all that. But the country simply felt no. Immigration. That's what we do. We go to your country, you know, and we become Paul Keating or Jim Bulger or we become John F. Kennedy. But you coming to ours? No. No. And they actually, you know, there's a referendum passed which did really reduce the rights say, for example, a baby born to a Chinese couple in Ireland is not automatically an Irish citizen. Now, I was appalled by this because I thought, hey, everybody, come on. We've got to actually take asylum seekers really seriously. We've also got to take the idea of cultural diversity really seriously. And we've got to take the idea that all over the world, in every city in Europe, in every city in the world, is being enriched hugely by the arrival of the Asian population, the Polish population, the Russian population, the Nigerian population. That is what cities are now. And to have an all-white, all-Irish, all-drinking, you know, all Guinness city, like, you just can't have, that's over. That belongs to the 40s even. And but it was an argument. In other words, it was an argument, I think, that we're only beginning to have.
Yes,
now.
These things are deeply, deeply controversial and on. I suppose this is because, I mean, Australian political leaders will often say Australians don't have enough history. But in Ireland, if it's possible, people have too much history. They can recall the Battle of the Boyne or Wolfetone or whoever it is, events like they were yesterday. I just wonder, having finally achieved independence from Britain, the Irish will now want to see their... Well, we've finished now. We've completed our cultural project and we don't want to dilute it, I suppose, is how they see it.
Yeah, I suppose there are two things involved. One, by looking at all that history, Cromwell and independence and the black and tans and independence, I think you're missing a central thing that happened over the last 150 years, which is a secret history of Ireland, which is that someone from every family in every generation left and they didn't come back. And there was a silence, almost a shame, almost a guilt around that so-and-so is in Birmingham and he might be back this summer, but he wasn't last summer. Or, you know, somebody's grandchildren coming home with English accents, or someone stopping writing from America. I haven't had a letter from so-and-so for a while. And suddenly that area of regret and loss, that actually affected people, I think, much more deeply than did, say, independence or the struggle for independence. And, yes, I think the idea that somehow or other we're pure, we got the Brits out, and now we need to be alone on our island. I think that is the most absurd idea, now especially, when there's such migration. And also migration, a city like London or a city like Sydney has been so enriched by having different races. I mean, nobody eats their own food anymore. There's no such thing as, you know, a potato-eating population of Sydney anymore. Everyone eats one another's food. And that's become, you know, and that's made its way into then, you know, schools, for example, are filled with, you know, these incredibly bright Asian kids who arrived who are really ambitious and serious. And I think Ireland needs much more of that.
I'm in conversation today with Irish writer Colm Tobin. He's my first guest today. His most recent novel is called Brooklyn. Now, you live in several different places. You live sort of partly in Ireland, partly in New York, and other places besides. What does that do? What does that do? Can you call both those places, New York and Ireland, home to you now?
No, New York is not home. What I do is I emigrate every year. in other words, I've been teaching in America for semesters, and it sounds like a great idea, except when you arrive. And I arrive at the beginning of February, and it's freezing. It's bone cold. It's much colder than Ireland ever gets. It gets into every part of you. It freezes your blood. And you wonder, when you wake up some morning and you face out into it, why did I agree to this? And everything's, New York is the sort of heart of the world, or it's, you know, the city that never sleeps. Oh my God, if you're trying to, you're waiting for a subway, it's sort of depressing. And so you see, so in other words, you get, for the first 4 weeks, I get depressed. Then I get exhilaration, and then I more or less have to go home. But so it's an interesting experience. I don't know how much longer I can go on doing it because, but no, New York isn't home. Ireland is home.
When I split my time for part of my life between the UK and Australia. And when I was in one place, the other place seemed to dissolve in my memory. It seemed like it was going away almost and perhaps becoming less real. And part of me, this is a weird thing to say, and I've only just really thought of it, when I'd go back to wherever I'd just been from, I'd sort of be kind of vaguely reassured that everything was pretty much as I'd left it behind.
Well, that's what I was trying to deal with in the book. The idea that space, that idea of when Eilish comes back to Ireland, and she's been in New York for 3 years, she's been in Brooklyn for 3 years, that things that matter to her enormously there dissolve, as you say, crumble. That experiences seem so rich, so important, including the experience of love, loyalty, being with somebody. Suddenly that seems oddly remote, because her mother, her mother's voice, the house where she was brought up in, her friends, the town she was brought up, now seems real, substantial, there, in a way that makes everything else seem shadowy, strange, and not worthy of her full attention, like as though she'd been dreaming it. So I was trying to dramatise that idea of moving between two places which are very far away from each other, what you've just been describing. And I hadn't read anybody describing that feeling. And it's a feeling I know as well. For example, I often spend the summers in Spain. And Spain is so rich. You know, the sun is so much there, the colours, the food, the morning. Everything is so real and true. But I would be in Ireland a day or two, having flown home. It would all seem remote, distant almost in time, but certainly crumbling already because the fact of your own home, going back in your own door, your own key, even food you don't even like, but just things you're used to, that becomes totally real again for you. And the time away becomes almost like a fantasy time. So I was trying to sort of work that out dramatically in a novel.
The town, both places in your book, Brooklyn, in the 1950s, the town of Enniscorthy and Brooklyn, are so vividly realised in all sorts of subtle ways. What connection do you have to Enniscorthy that has a childhood connection to you?
You know, I'm from there. Three of my grandparents were even born there. You know, so that it's only got 6,000 people. And because my father was a teacher and my two sisters were teachers, you know, we know a lot about the town. You learn a lot about, you know, and so I'm fully, I suppose the word would be embedded in it, you know, in that I would know everybody there. And I know the contours. I know every corner. I know how the wind blows, what you can see from there and there. I know what shops were there because, of course, you know, you remember as a kid that shop was there. And beside it was another shop, and you're 5 years old. So that, you know, I have a memory that almost goes back 50 years now of the place as it changed slowly and as people changed slowly. So that I have an absolute hinterland, which has a lot of emotion attached to it, that I can constantly work from and mine. And I'm always careful when I use it to name it, to call it Enniscorthy. It's not a fictional place. It's a real place. I know it. And that's what I was using in the book. That's where she comes from. And that's where she comes back to.
Writers are supposed to be rootless cosmopolitans, aren't they? But you own a place now in Enniscorthy, don't you?
Yeah.
Tell me what that does for you, owning a place there.
I built a house about 10 miles away. Because my father was a teacher, we could spend the summers on the beach. It was really cheap. You could rent huts and little beach houses and stuff. And I found planning permission to build a house just there. And that for me was almost the home I remembered better than the town almost, because 3 months of the summer spent there without having to go to school, long days and the beach, and there was a cliff and the sea and all that. So going back there is really odd. There are times when you're going for a walk and the smell of maybe a field of clover or the smell of something coming from the sea is exactly the smell from childhood. It's exactly the smell. That house that's there, the following house, were there exactly then. And the little house I passed where she used to sell sweets when we were kids, and you look in, that's that place. And so you know every person there, because it hasn't, not many new houses have been built, and a lot of the people are still there from 40, 50 years ago.
Is that comforting? The people haven't moved
it's,
on.
It's totally comforting. It's like finding the blanket that you were so attached to as a child, or the teddy bear. That you wouldn't go to sleep without having your teddy. It's very like reverting to childhood. So it's terribly useful for a novelist, because you're getting all those images back, very richly coming back, not just as echo, but as full experience again.
Do you get irritated when people have the audacity to change and grow and leave these places and things happen?
I suppose, yeah. I mean, if someone knocked down a ditch down there, I'd say, oh, it's a pity that ditch couldn't be left where it was, because I liked it. It was always there. Like, I know what ditches. You know, in other words, there are ditches made of grass that are all growing wild. If someone put a fence up, I'd say, oh, my God. I suppose that I like that place to be the same.
Is there part of you that likes that unsettled feeling from moving about? And does that trigger memory and writing in your case?
Yeah, I find that getting on planes, getting on trains, that funny moment of turning from one place to another gives me an enormous amount of imaginative energy. I mean that I can get ideas in that second where you arrive or that second where you're leaving. Something can trigger. And it probably wouldn't happen if I was stable, if I lived in the same place and just sat there day in, day out, went for the same walk day in, day out. While it's lovely to have gone back there, you know, travelling is really, really useful for me. Not only because I just enjoy it anyway, but it's useful for work in that I get ideas from it. It actually, I don't know, it fizzes the blood in a way which is useful for me.
Peter Carey moved from Sydney to New York some decades ago and has written nearly always about Australia from New York. Do you need to do that? Do you need to leave Ireland to write about Ireland?
No, I'm not sure that I could leave permanently. You know, I could settle in New York as Peter Carey had. I think I would really miss it too much. I also think I'm too old. I think you need to do that younger. But I do like traveling, but I also, the idea of losing Ireland, of not having it, would be too much for me.
Tell me about the most, when you earliest remember that feeling of homesickness and the quality of it.
Oh, they sent me to boarding school when I was 15, and I have a terrible habit of thinking things are going to be okay, of not putting any thought into things that are about to happen. You know, so I just thought it'd be fine. I knew other people who went to boarding school, they seemed fine, and no one said anything to me about it. So I just arrived, and I was put into my cubicle, and all the other boys were there, and you know, there was a certain excitement about being around so many guys, you know, and I mean, even though I was only 15, I, you know, took certain...
But it was interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and but within 3 days, a depression had settled on me that I couldn't get out of, and I didn't know what it was called. I simply couldn't function. And I couldn't sleep, couldn't eat, couldn't function. And I didn't know that was what homesickness was and that it would lift, and that it would eventually, with the habit of days, just dissolve itself. I didn't know that. So it was panic because suddenly, if you're 15 years old, it's the most frightening idea that it was like a cloud. And I'm not given to depression. I don't suffer from it, you know, since. But that wrench from home, and thinking I'd lost home, it was over, that I was suddenly isolated in this place, it was a feeling that I used in the book. It was the feeling I gave Eilish when she arrives in Brooklyn first. I mean, exactly that one where you don't know what it's called, but it's fierce and unrelenting and won't leave you alone, and it's called homesick.
I think the way we talk about our feelings governs the way we do feel them, and it's interesting that I just couldn't help but notice the way you said a Great Depression settled upon me. It's often denoted that in Australia or England, people will say, I got depressed, but Irish people will tend to say, I feel a sadness upon me, or a depression settled upon me, like it's something out there that lands upon you.
That's almost a direct translation from the Gaelic, oddly enough, but yeah. But I suppose there's one way of looking at it, that it was something out there came towards me and hit me, rather than something in me happened. I mean, I felt it was very much like a weight had descended on me.
From outside of me, yeah.
I did feel that, yeah.
There's a lot of Jane Austen in your book. It's only really struck me towards the end. I wasn't there's a Mr. Darcy character almost. Clear he's Mr. Darcy.
I stole a few things from Jane. I hope she doesn't mind if she's smiling down at us now. For example, there's an opening scene at a dance where there are two guys. One guy's really nice. He's Mr. Bingley.
Yes.
And the other guy is George in my novel, is Mr. Darcy, and he's incredibly rude to Eilish. And that's taken directly from the dance scene in Pride and Prejudice. And also I was interested within Pride and Prejudice of the way in which certain women, like Lady Catherine de Bourgh or Mrs. Bennet, are handled. In other words, if Jane Austen wants to create excitement, she brings them in and has them say something so horrible, so nasty, so snobbish, so generally stupid and unthought out, that I did the same thing to a woman called Nettles Kelly, who owns a shop, and indeed to Mrs. Keough, that I have them sort of saying the same sort of things as Mrs. Bennet and Lady Catherine de Bourgh would say. But yes, I do then have, of course, Darcy, or George in my book, turning round and finally realising where his heart really is in the book.
And there's a reason why he behaves the way he behaves.
Yeah, he does, because a girl coming home from America to Ireland with an American suntan, an American clothes, an American confidence, looks like nobody else in the world. And that's true even to this day, where there would be some glamour attached to America that would change the way your shoulders were, your hair, your confidence, and it would give you a sort of a sexy allure. But I have to say, I mean, I'm sure Birmingham is fine, but coming back from Birmingham would not make you sexier. coming back from Brooklyn, coming back from Brooklyn Wood.
It's impossible for that to happen, actually. It's completely impossible. It's odd to look back on this novel and realise that you never describe what Eilish looks like, the main character.
Yeah, no, very deliberately, because she's not conscious of her own appearance. She doesn't ever look in the mirror and think, I'm actually quite a good-looking girl. You realise slowly, by the response of people to her, everybody likes her. And then you realise that Tony, who's the Italian guy who meets her, he really fancies her. And you realise he notices her the minute she appears in the dance hall. But she is one of those girls who has no sense of her own, how attractive she is. She's worried about herself. She's timid. So that you realise slowly. But if you over-describe her and you have her self-consciously thinking about herself, then you lose that idea of how surprised she is, in a way, when Tony wants her as much as he does.
And how surprising she is, too. She grows very subtly during the course of the novel.
Yeah, I mean, she's capable of quite bad behaviour. I mean, she goes to a dance. She's meant to be a terribly good person, a decent person. She goes to a dance with a girl who's sort of, who's very badly dressed and is from a lower class than her, like is a domestic servant. And she just decides halfway through the dance to ditch the girl, just to stand up. And I mean, when I thought of it, I thought, right, I know what I'm going to do now. Instead of her sitting with her and being good and walking home with her and listening to her, she's going to stand up and ditch her and go over and be with more glamorous people. The thing is, she doesn't always do things like that, but every so often she does something quite assertive. You know, that I think nowadays that's called passive aggressive, but in the 50s there was probably no word for it.
It's wonderful to meet you, Colin Tobin, and I did love the novel. I really did. It's not a word wasted in it. It's so spare and beautiful, and I can't only imagine if you had to take so much out of it to give it that spareness and energy, but it's a real pleasure to read. And thank you so much, sir, for being my guest in conversation.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
In March 2008, Bruce Laurie and Rick Smith made a pact. They decided to shut themselves away and feed themselves poison. The interesting thing is where they got their poisons. They got them from everyday items you've got in your house right now. From hair care products, from non-stick fry pans, from antibacterial hand wash, children's toys, even tuna fish. Bruce and Rick were using their bodies as laboratories to see how that we ingest these chemicals, which range from the somewhat toxic to the very toxic, and how long they stay in our bodies. They published their findings in their book with a wonderful title. It's called Slow Death by Rubber Duck, How the Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Life Affects Our Health. Rick Smith and Bruce Laurie are both leading Canadian environmentalists. Rick's the Executive Director of Environmental Defence, and Bruce started one of Canada's largest environmental consultancies, and he's President of the Ivy Foundation. Rick and Bruce, welcome to Conversations, the both of you.
Great, thank you so much.
Pleasure to be here.
I must ask you first, Bruce, how are you? You all right?
I'm very well, thank you.
You look well?
Yeah, considering we flew in this morning from Canada.
No, I'm talking about just this morning now. You're off the plane now, are you?
Yes, yes.
What's worse for you, ingesting mercury in tuna or the long-distance flight, I wonder?
I think the flight.
Rick, tell me how you encountered triclosan on your garden hose.
Yes, I was... triclosan is this chemical in a lot of antibacterial products, so things like hand wash and dish soap. In North America, anyway, it's in certain kinds of toothpaste. You can find it even in antiperspirants and shaving products. It's one of the few chemicals we looked at in the book that's actually properly labeled, ironically because it's a registered pesticide. It's a registered pesticide. And then sometime in the 1990s, some genius thought it would be a great thing to put in toothpaste. Go figure. But it's labeled on products. So in our house, we've been avoiding it for years. So it's the one chemical in the book I was feeling a little bit smug about.
You're feeling pretty good about the fact you've managed to keep triclosan out of your life.
That's right. I was feeling good about it. I was feeling smug about it. And then one night I was watering our little vegetable garden in the back, and I realized on my garden hose, on my green plastic garden hose, it said Microban Protected. And Microban is the... the trade name for triclosan. So it turns out that for years I've been watering my tomato plants with this antibacterial garden hose.
Why would anyone want to? I mean, I know you're not manufacturing this sort of thing, but why would anyone want to impregnate a garden hose with an antibacterial agent?
Well, it's just a great example of a story that we see time and again with these chemicals. Triclosan's only made by one chemical company, so they have the patent, and they have successfully over the past decade insinuated this chemical into any number of unlikely products in our homes. Things like you can now find triclosan in socks, in garden hoses, in the steering wheels of some new cars. If you get your kitchen renovated, you can now get countertops that are impregnated with triclosan. You can now get underwear that's impregnated with triclosan. I'm not quite sure what the logic is there. I guess
I got an idea.
I guess that way you never have to wash your underwear again, which doesn't seem right to me. But it's a great example of a chemical company just running amok.
Is it safe for widespread use, Bruce, triclosan?
No, as Rick says, it's a registered pesticide, so we shouldn't be putting pesticides in our healthcare products. And in most cases, these kinds of chemicals are put there because the chemical companies have succeeded in selling the chemical to the manufacturer. It's not because consumers are demanding, antimicrobial garden hoses. So first and foremost, these things shouldn't be there. They don't need to be there. And in fact, things like triclosan, which you can find in antibacterial soaps, do more harm than good because they create superbugs. And, with things like H1N1 and these, fears of epidemics that we see out there, most people don't realize that they're viruses. They're not bacteria, so they don't really do anything for those kinds of bugs. And in fact, in North America, both the American Medical Association and the Canadian Medical Association suggest that we shouldn't be using these antibacterial products.
Is that link between antibacterial products like triclosan and superbugs that you're talking about really clear? Because isn't it more to often doctors will point to the overuse of antibiotics instead of these antibacterial agents?
Well, that's certainly the overuse of antibiotics is a very important cause. But increasingly, doctors, and as Bruce mentions, both the doctors' organizations in Canada and the United States, very conservative bodies, have now also mentioned this triclosan chemical as being behind their concern.
And they're just another form of antibiotic. That's what they are. They're antibiotics that are used in commercial products.
It's interesting. I don't suppose there was a market for these things until the need was created. I mean, Australia was inundated with ads for new cleaning products that now brag that they are antibacterial. And there's a kind of insinuation behind the ads as well, like, unless you're using this stuff, you're a bad mother.
Yeah. Oh, very much so. It's deliberate marketing around this whole idea that we have to be, super clean and super sanitary. And in fact, it's mostly just marketing.
How did you bring triclosan into your life? You sort of go cold turkey for a while, and then as part of your experiment, you brought it into yours. Where did you ingest it from, Rick?
Well, I mean, like many of the chemicals that we experimented with in the book, we simply went to our local supermarket, bought well-known brand name off-the-shelf products. So for triclosan, I bought a triclosan toothpaste, just a normal Colgate toothpaste. I bought some antibacterial hand wash, an antiperspirant, a shaving product, about a half dozen products in all. And then I just used them normally over a two-day period. I brushed my teeth the same way I always do. I shaved the same way I always do. And the result was, over a two-day period, that my blood levels of this chemical increased by almost 3,000 times. So just a mind-blowing increase in a very short period of time.
Enough to do you... I mean, it gets processed through the body pretty quickly. Does it ever stay in your body long enough to actually do you any harm, though?
Triclosan... We looked at different kinds of chemicals in the book. So some chemicals like bisphenol A that's in some plastic containers. We looked at phthalates that carries the scent in a lot of products in the bathroom. And we looked at triclosan. Chemicals like that are, in fact, flushed from the body relatively quickly. And then we also.
Can they stay there long enough to do you any damage, though?
Well, I think the issue is that they're. Yes. Right, the short answer is yes. But the issue is that if you're using these products on a daily basis, then you always have them in your body. And so the question isn't so much as well the quantity of the chemical in your body. It's, in fact, the timing. So these are very unusual chemicals. They're called hormone-disrupting chemicals. So they mimic hormones in your body when it's developing. And minute amounts, parts per billion, introduced at a certain time as an infant or a fetus is developing, can actually cause harm.
Tell me how the genesis, where the genesis of this plan lay with you guys to lock yourselves up and poison yourselves with some of these more relatively somewhat toxic to very toxic things that are part of everyday life.
Well, Rick likes to pretend that he doesn't recall who actually came up with this idea. But
of course he doesn't. He's got toxic stuff in his system.
Right.
But
I can tell you it was Rick's idea, and I somehow went along with it. But we've been doing work on these issues for many years in Canada. We've tested the blood of Canadians, famous Canadians, politicians, and families. And so we knew that there were chemicals, like literally over 100 chemicals in most people. And so rather than just testing our blood and finding out what we had in ourselves, we thought, well, let's see if we can't, affect the levels in our bodies just by doing everyday things that millions of Australians wouldn't do every day.
And how did you prepare yourself so the results would be as accurate as possible?
Well, for some chemicals like triclosan, like bisphenol A, we actually went through a period where we tried to bring our levels down before trying to jack them up again. Other chemicals like Teflon, for instance, we spend a lot of time in the book looking at the Teflon family of chemicals. So the whole grouping of non-stick stain repellent chemicals that are in everything from lipstick to frying pans to toaster ovens these days. Chemicals like that actually persist in the body for years. And so for those chemicals, we just started off with whatever level we had. And we took a week out of our lives, and we chose 7 chemicals that the people would encounter every day. And then we constructed, as Bruce said, a series of methodical experiments over the course of the week.
And we had scientific experts advising us on each of the experiments, so we knew which chemicals, whether or not the experiments we were doing would likely result in an increase in our bodies.
And you were testing blood and urine for the presence of these chemicals.
That's right. And then there's labs that we used around North America that are expert labs in doing the analyses.
I'm talking to Bruce Laurie and Rick Smith, who are looking remarkably healthy, which is a nice thing considering. Their book is called Slow Death by Rubber Duck, How the Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Life Affects Our Health. They use their own bodies for their own experiment. Let's move on to the phthalates, what they are. What are they, and where are they present?
They're a very interesting chemical. They're a synthetic oil. So if we had a jar of phthalates in front of us, it would look like vegetable oil. They have a few unique properties. They carry scent very well. So any product in your bathroom, your shampoo, your conditioner, your shaving gels,
deodorants, that sort of thing.
Deodorants, yeah. Anything in your bathroom, aftershaves, perfumes. Anything with a heavy artificial scent will have a very high concentration of phthalates.
They exist in toys as well. Why are they in toys?
They're very common in toys. They're very common in vinyl toys because vinyl in its natural state is hard as a brick. And so if you want to make vinyl pliable, if you want to make something that looks like a rubber duck, for instance, that's soft and squeaky and lovable, and you want to loosen that vinyl up, then this phthalate oil is a good thing to add.
So phthalates are the difference between an LP record, an old LP record, and a rubber duck, essentially.
That is exactly right.
They make it bendy.
That's a great analogy.
They make it bendy and squeaky.
Yeah. So like vinyl shower curtains, for example, that you purchase, and you open the package, and there's kind of a wafting smell that comes off them. That's the phthalates in the vinyl.
How toxic are they to humans, phthalates?
They're quite, the evidence is in. There's now a mountain of scientific studies strongly linking this chemical to breast cancer, to prostate cancer. In fact, some of the groups in North America who are most active now trying to get a ban on this chemical are breast cancer organizations because phthalates are a very potent hormone disruptor. They're an estrogen-mimicking chemical. And all the evidence with breast cancer now is that a woman's lifetime risk of breast cancer is to a large extent shaped by her lifetime exposure to estrogenic compounds.
See, I'm when you tell me about rubber ducks, I'm thinking that my two kids had rubber ducks and consistently put them in their mouths when it was bath time.
Well, that's absolutely that is the problem, and so that is the reason why in North America, in the United States, and in Canada, just in the past year, we've got both countries to ban phthalates in kids' toys meant for kids under 3 years old. So rubber ducks, really vinyl ducks, because most rubber ducks are actually made out of vinyl. Vinyl ducks in North America, anyway, are not going to contain this chemical in the future.
To detox beforehand, there was an interesting experiment that went before that, Rick. I understand you tried to live without plastics for how long?
I tried to go for 3 days, and I tried to eat. This was to try to bring my levels of phthalates and bisphenol A, which is in a lot of plastic containers, down before we started to try to build them back up again.
And how hard was it to live without plastic for 3 days?
It was incredibly difficult. And your listeners, I mean, if your listeners are up for it, they should try this just for a day. It's very difficult these days to avoid food that has come in contact with plastic. So all of my favorite snack treats were out. All my favorite chips and things were out.
Bottles of mayonnaise and chili sauce, that kind of thing?
I mean, every time you go to the grocery store, I'm sure it's the same thing here in Australia. Every time you go to the grocery store, products that used to come in glass now come in plastic. So, you know, ketchup, mustard. I'm not sure if Vegemite still comes in still comes in glass.
It's been a while since I banged a jar of that on a bench to see how what it's actually made of. I don't know if I ever give it much thought. I know jam still comes pretty much in
glass.
In glass, yes. Yeah. I'm not sure about other products like that. So you have to give up all those things. And what about things like sushi, for instance, that comes in little plastic trays?
Yeah, absolutely. Most prepackaged food comes wrapped in plastic. In fact, a lot of prepackaged food comes in plastic that is then meant to be microwaved, which of course exacerbates the problem, because whenever you heat plastic of any sort, the chemicals in that plastic then ooze into the food. You then absorb that into your body. For this phthalate experiment, I tried to go 3 days. I did go 3 days without coming in contact with plastic, and it was quite difficult.
Every time I try to reheat leftovers at work leftovers from the night before in a plastic container in the microwave, my producer gives me a whack with a rolled-up sheaf of notes. Is she right to do so?
Oh, for sure.
She is?
Oh, that's a good thing.
It's good for her to whack me with...
Absolutely, yeah.
And this is for this very thing that Rick is talking
yes,
about.
You should. Yeah, you just simply shouldn't microwave food in plastic. That's a no-no.
Why? Tell me more about what.
Well, as you heat the food, and in fact, one of the experiments we did on bisphenol A is taking containers, so BPA, they're containers that are made of plastic with bisphenol A, and they're called microwavable containers. These aren't just things that shouldn't be microwaved. And we did this, this was an experiment Rick did over this period of time, and in 2.5 days had a 7 times increase of bisphenol A in his blood. And it just, it shows very directly that if you are doing this, if you're putting heated liquids in plastic, those chemicals will get into your body. And these are the same cancer-causing chemicals.
Bisphenol A has been linked with cancer, as you say.
Yes,
it has, and it's still, as I understand it, in Australia, still present in many market-leading baby bottles, present in a lot of kids' products. Exposure of children to these chemicals that we're talking about is of particular concern, because scientists and doctors are very clear on the fact that the growing bodies of children, the developing brains of kids, are particularly susceptible to these kinds of pollutants. So it's not unimportant that adults try to reduce levels of pollutants in our bodies, but it's very important with kids because they can develop problems later in life.
And we're starting to see now in industrialized countries epidemics that are unexplainable but are now being linked to the pervasive use of chemicals, things like autism and ADHD, obesity, asthma. These are epidemic proportions among children.
How strong are those connections, though? Because that's highly contested, a lot of that research you're talking about, isn't it?
There's a very strong mounting evidence. I would say it's not highly contested. It's starting to show very strong correlations, and the medical community is now starting to look at this as one of the major contributors to these epidemics, which are otherwise unexplainable.
Many of the chemicals, or some of the chemicals you're talking about that are a result of industrial byproducts, I think they're called pseudoestrogens, aren't they? They have a molecular resemblance to estrogen.
Yes, exactly.
What's this doing to blokes? What's this doing to men? Not just in the animal kingdom, in the animal kingdom in general. It's,
Well, this is of particular interest to me, not just because of my manhood, but because I have two little boys. And there are increasing problems in little boys with problems with reproductive systems. So things like undescended testicles and malformations of genitalia, those are actually increasing in commonness in little boys these days. In some communities in North America that are particularly inundated with these kinds of hormone disrupting chemicals, you actually see now sex ratios of babies shifting, and you see less little boys being born, which is quite a worrisome, freaky thing. But it seems to be the case that that male fetuses are more susceptible to some of these chemicals than female fetuses are. And finally, there's very significant links between all the chemicals that we're talking about in prostate cancer. So much so that before he left office, the George Bush government, and George W. Bush, not normally known,
the environmentalist friend,
normally known as the greenest president in American history. So strong is this correlation between these between phthalates in particular and prostate and breast cancer that Bush was the president that actually banned phthalates from kids' toys, particularly because of concern about childhood exposure to these chemicals.
You're saying seems to be a lot. How much evidence is there for what you're saying, though?
Again, so much so that that the environmentally unfriendly government of the United States moved on this in 2008. You see now major medical associations coming out on some of these chemicals like triclosan. In North America, anyway, you see mainstream cancer organizations mobilizing to try to get these chemicals out of products. So the evidence in the peer-reviewed scientific literature is very strong.
Yeah, one of the challenges we have with these chemicals is that they can occur at very small amounts, and it takes many, many years for an effect to be seen. So it's not like some of the chemicals that we've seen in the past, like lead, where you can have a direct exposure that leads to an almost immediate health effect. So these aren't the classic poisons that we know of. So our regulatory system can't deal with these chemicals in the same way. So this whole notion that, you know, we need a smoking gun, we need evidence, we need dead bodies, that's just not going to happen with these chemicals. So we have to get away from some of the older notions we have of, you know, show us the evidence, and we have to look at these things in a precautionary way and basically look at the weight of the evidence and make precautionary decisions.
Earlier you mentioned Teflon. Most of us have nonstick fry pans. What's wrong with Teflon?
Well, Teflon is one of those compounds, again, it's a synthetic chemical that mimics hormones. It's linked to cancer. It's linked to asthma. It's in a huge range of products that we have in our homes, in our clothes, in our cars, in our makeup. And it's a nasty chemical. If you have a frying pan that's coated with a nonstick coating like Teflon, and you turn the element on your stove up to high and leave it there for 10 minutes, if you have a bird in your kitchen, it will be dead. The gases,
what?
Yeah, absolutely. The gases coming off the pan will actually destroy the lungs of the bird. So it's the classic canary in a coal mine In this case, it's a canary in the kitchen. And so there are highly toxic gases that come off of heating Teflon at high temperatures. And I'm convinced, the evidence again here, that we will see Teflon largely replaced probably within the next 5 years.
Bruce, part of the experiment was you ingested above average levels of mercury by eating tuna fish. What happened when you did that?
Well, that's a good example of a chemical where, again, you know, I stopped eating fish. I love fish. I stopped eating fish, much to my dismay, for about 3 months. And then I ate basically 7 meals of tuna over a 3-day period. So not excessive amounts, a couple tuna sandwiches, tuna sushi, tuna steak. And I nearly tripled my mercury levels in that 3-day period to the point where they went above what's considered safe. And mercury is a potent neurotoxin. So unlike some of the other chemicals that we talked about, mercury actually affects your brain. It attacks your neurons. But in the same way as the others, it's most concern for children as they're developing.
How did Bruce's excessive consumption of mercury change his character, Rick?
Well, he was a little bit more addle-witted than usual.
Than usual,
yeah. a little bit more befuddled than usual, but I think his mercury experiment's a good example of a point that we should make here because we've been talking about how easily we were able to dramatically elevate these chemicals in our bodies. I think the important point to underline here is that the book actually has quite a hopeful message in this regard. So, yes, we were able to dramatically increase our levels of a lot of these chemicals by doing things that people do every day. But we also watched levels of these chemicals start to come down after we stopped doing these things.
All right. So what concrete steps do you recommend most of us take to rid ourselves or put these chemicals at bay from our systems?
Yeah. Well, there's a few very basic things that people can start doing right away that we can guarantee will lower the toxic levels in their bodies. So certainly avoiding eating too much tuna. And if you're pregnant or thinking of becoming pregnant, you should eat no tuna at all. That's how serious the mercury is. Don't microwave your food in plastic. Eat as much organic food as you can find or afford. Avoid using nonstick pans for cooking and those stain repellent chemicals. And don't buy products that have antibacterial chemicals in them or personal care products that are highly fragrant.
What about toys? Do you have to go cold turkey on toys altogether? Because most of them are made of this stuff, aren't they? I mean, what do we do about toys?
Well, so there are different kinds of plastic, and so we're not saying in the book that, you know, all plastic is evil. There are different kinds of plastic. Most plastics, plastic toys, plastic containers have a little recycling number on the bottom. And so the number's 7. People should avoid number 7, which is usually bisphenol A plastics, and that goes with toys, so very common in toys. Number 3 is often is usually vinyl. And we've talked about vinyl containing phthalates, this hormone-disrupting chemical. A lot of toys in my kids' toy box are numbers 4, 5, 1, and 2, which are polypropylene, polyethylene. Those plastics are less of a problem. So the message on toys is be cautious of vinyl toys and be cautious of toys containing polycarbonate plastic.
And we really aren't trying to spoil people's lives. I should make that clear.
Because the look in your face.
That's not a big ask. Great to meet you both, gentlemen, and thank you so much for being my guest in conversation.
Great. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
That's Bruce Laurie and Rick Smith. Their book is called Slow Death by Rubber Duck, How the Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Life Affects Our Health.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.